Welcome to JGL Law for You. This podcast is sponsored by Joseph Greenwald & Lake, a suburban Maryland law firm that has been representing clients throughout the District of Columbia and Maryland, as well as across the country, for close to 50 years. JGL Law for You is a podcast by lawyers, but not for lawyers only. On JGL Law for You, we will bring you up close and personal with our lawyers and some special guests who will be discussing how to navigate the many legal processes, developments in the law, other current events, and how they may affect you, your family, or your business. Today we have an interesting topic. What is a whistleblower case and do I have one? And to give you the answers to those questions, we have Sarah Chu with us today. Sarah is an associate at Joseph Greenwald & Lake. She works in the QTAM practice, representing whistleblowers nationwide in sealed investigations and unsealed litigation under the Federal and State False Claims Acts. Sarah joined JGL in 2016 while she pursued her law degree at the University of Maryland School of Law and has worked almost exclusively on QTAM matters since. She continues to represent whistleblowers in cases that involve various types of fraud, including healthcare fraud and government procurement fraud perpetrated by various actors. Welcome aboard, Sarah. We're happy to have you this morning.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me. Welcome, JGL Law for You listeners.
Excellent. Well, let me start with what's probably a stupid question, Sarah, but what is QTAM? Can you tell the folks out there, you know, it sounds like something you might get at the grocery store. What does that mean?
Right. So QTAM is this, you know, Latin term, right? A lot of these, you know, a lot of my clients come to me, they Google false claims or they Google fraud or misconduct, and they realize, what is QTAM? What is QTAM? You know, how do I pronounce it? You know, what do I do with this? And so the term QTAM comes from, you know, the statute False Claims Act. And the False Claims Act is designed to combat fraud committed against the government. And, you know, just sort of to segue into the anti-fraud statute, I mean, basically, it's traditionally understood to encompass instances where an entity submits a bill to the government for work that was not performed or work that was not performed poorly. So QTAM, QTAM, False Claims Act, it encompasses this whole whistleblower litigation practice that my clients come to me with when they want to file a case against their employer for various types of government fraud.
All right. So before we start talking about what that means in your practice and so forth, can people bring these types of actions both in a state court, be it Maryland or Montana or Illinois, or also a federal court or both?
Both. So the answer to that is both. Federal and state court. In the healthcare sector, for example, if you were to file a case that involves Medicare, for example, that would be federal dollars, right? So you can immediately file that with the federal court. There's also Medicaid money, TRICARE. So anything that involves state care, state dollars can be filed with the state court. So both.
And are there circumstances where you, as counsel to someone who comes to see you, might decide or has the option, might prefer to file your action in state court or federal court?
Absolutely. We obviously provide different legal options and different, you know, ways to explore how to file with a federal court or how to file with the state court. But generally, we give them the option. We give them lots of different legal options to explore when they want to file a case under the False Claims Act.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about that. You know, walk us through something that might happen to someone that would bring them to you to talk to you about, let's go with whistleblower. We'll call it that. I'll stay away from the Latin. To talk about that type of a case with you, what type of a circumstance might arise?
So whistleblowers are also referred to as relators in my case. And, you know, just to go back to who can become a whistleblower, the short answer to that question is really anyone, right? Almost anyone with evidence or fraud or misconduct can blow the whistle on their current or former employer. In other words, if you have information about misconduct observed in the workplace, you might be interested in exploring an opportunity to file suit under federal and state False Claims Act against your employer. But you also want to keep in mind that only certain types of fraud can make a government whistleblower case under the FCA. And so some very common types of fraud covered under the statute, categorized more in the broader sense, includes healthcare, pharmaceutical fraud, We've got government procurement fraud, smaller disadvantaged business set-aside fraud. We've got grant and education fraud, tax and securities, and more recently, COVID-19 related fraud.
So when you talk about someone being a relator, what does that mean exactly? When they come to your office, this person makes an appointment with you and they come in, what are they telling you that leads to the potential for this type of a case under the False Claims Act?
I have a lot of different clients who come from a lot of different workplace sectors. And let's say you are in healthcare, right? I've got a nurse in home health or a therapist working at a skilled nursing facility. In that particular regime, they might be suspicious of billing for unreasonable and medically unnecessary procedures. They might see some upcoding going on to bill for services at a higher rate. And keep in mind that these healthcare facilities are treating Medicare and Medicaid patients, right? So this is government funds and government dollars that we're talking about. And so when they're billing for unreasonable and medically unnecessary procedures, I mean, that's fraud. Upcoding to bill for services that might not have occurred or might have been performed poorly or at a higher rate that shouldn't be billed, I mean, that's also fraud against the government. I've also had some clients who are more at the executive level where they see kickbacks being paid to physicians for patient referrals. That's also fraud because all of the claims that are submitted to the government under that kickback scheme is considered a violation of the federal and state False Claims Act.
How would someone do that? In terms of what does that kind of a kickback look like when you say kickbacks to the doctors? What does that look like to the average bear?
Oftentimes, I mean, the easiest way to sort of explain that would be, you know, the anti-kickback statute, which is another sort of statute that is often works in parallel with the False Claims Act violations, is that these, you know, they can be monetary fees, obviously. They can be incentives in the form of, you know, lavish wine and dine situations, taking them out to dinners, taking them to, I had a client who, you know, often saw their executives taking out physicians to Pebble Beach for a long 3-4 day golf course event, all expenses paid. So they'd be taken out to these, you know, lavish wine and dines, and they would be taken to golf events and things like that. And they would be paid incentives for these physicians to provide, to send referrals, patient referrals to a hospital that would be in connection with them. And so that would be sort of the most basic prohibition that the anti-kickback statute would be, you know, in violation of.
All right. And to tag that back up to the False Claims Act, what exactly constitutes fraud under the False Claims Act?
So the most basic thing that the government really sees when they're investigating in these types of fraud is that there has to be a false claims, right, submitted to the government. So going back to your question about kickbacks and things like that, violation of an anti-kickback statute isn't always an immediate violation of the False Claims Act. We've got to see claims that are being filed to the government, billed to the government for those kickback tainted claims that are, you know, resonated from the kickback scheme. And so usually they're looking for fraudulent statements, you know, false claims, false records and things like that. But the false claims has to be there in order for there to be a direct violation of the False Claims Act.
All right. And when you say a false claim, again, just so folks are clear, what does that mean?
So just to give an example, we've got, you know, a nurse working from home health, right? And they treat the patient, they provide, you know, whatever symptoms and treatment that is provided for a particular patient on the patient record. The billings department in that defendant company bills the government directly for whatever services that were provided to the particular patients. And I don't want to go into the weeds by using, you know, CPT codes or procedure codes or things like that.
Yeah, don't do that.
Right. There are billing codes that translate into dollars that are submitted to the government for reimbursement for those Medicare patients. And so, you know, when the government is in receipt of those billing information, they rely on the provider, the healthcare provider, providing the treatment to the patients to provide accurate treatment, first of all, and to provide the accurate codes to be able to reimburse the provider for those funds. And oftentimes we see a lot of these healthcare facilities not doing that. And so that would be a false claim being billed to the government, which is a direct violation of the False Claims Act.
And are there red flags for people to keep their eyes out for in the event they're in that industry for the potential for fraud?
Absolutely. I went over a couple things for the healthcare regime, the billing, the upcoding, and things like that. One of my other, you know, personal favorite issues to explore, as much of a nerd as I am, is pertaining to government procurement contracts, right? And in that regime, you might be suspicious of bid rigging, best pricing requirements. You know, we've got government contractors who are often subcontracting with small businesses in order to take advantage of some of these requirements provided by the government to, you know, falsely certify and falsely fraudulently induce these contracts to be executed. And so, you know, you really need to be mindful of some of this, you know, internal company procedures, internal corporate instructions that, you know, instruct their employees to go through bid rigging, best pricing, and things like that. I mean, those are some of the red flags that you would see in a different sector away from the healthcare industry.
All right. So if I'm someone who's an employee in this industry, and I think there's something that just doesn't smell right, what do I do? Do I call a lawyer? And you know, what do I do? And what do I bring? What should I prepare myself to tell that lawyer if I make an appointment?
Great question. You know, I generally advise folks to talk to an attorney sooner rather than later. Initial consults, especially with JGL attorneys, are typically free. There are no obligations and completely confidential. And it would be more beneficial for you to find out what legal options are out there at a juncture where your information may be the most timeliest to pursue a case. Oftentimes, that you might not be the only one that has noticed the red flag in the defendant company, right? And so, you know, there might be somebody else who wants to file a case under the False Claims Act. And you want to be the first one to file that case because there's first to file issues that, you know, pertain to the False Claims Act statute. So it would be more beneficial for you to talk to an attorney sooner rather than later to see whether you have a case. And, you know, when you talk to an attorney, our lawyers assess each case very thoroughly before we make a decision to take the case. So, you know, we as JGL lawyers representing whistleblowers, we assess each case very thoroughly before we make a decision to take the case. I think as a starting point, a client's testimony, their story, their narrative, when they come to me, it's really valuable for building credibility to the case. Sometimes it's not enough in certain situations. So I like to see documentary evidence, incriminating emails, text messages of the defendant company coming in. A lot of my clients are taking contemporary notes, especially if they are currently employed with that company. And so billing records, patient files, anything substantive that will corroborate the client's story is really key to me. On the other hand, there might not be a lot of documentary evidence, right? And that's okay too. I vet the client and I invite the client to help me and see if they have enough knowledge to help me develop a discovery plan, is what I call it, to steer the government in a direction where they could find the documentary evidence that the client initially could not provide. So I wouldn't be discouraged if you don't have, you know, a hot smoking gun showing the false billing or the patient files or notes or things like that. I mean, those are helpful things that I look for and I value it as I assess the case. But if you don't have that, then we have some work to do in terms of helping the government go through the investigation.
So as someone who, you know, reads the newspaper and reads the news, and there's a lot of articles about these types of cases. You see them pretty regularly throughout the media these days. Is there any way for you as someone who's meeting someone for the first time or the first couple of times to sort of how to pick and choose which you think are the cases that have merit and push out those that you don't think have merit?
That's a good question. You're right. There are a lot of media coverage. You know, the Department of Justice are constantly pushing out press releases with these big recovery cases. I mean, we use them as sort of a focal point. I use them as references to see, you know, what cases have been successful, what the government wants, what you know, the government is looking for in order to settle a case with the defendant company. And I use them as reference and as a guide, really, as a practicing attorney to kind of marry what I've learned from that and take my client's facts and the situation and see how I can assess the merits of their case, right? And I've seen a trend where, for example, in the healthcare sector, governments really like kickback cases. It's pretty clean cut. If they see that the money has been transacted to a physician to provide that patient referral, they're going to get to it immediately. And so they take usually a bite at more of the kickback cases than not. So in terms of merit, I mean, there could be merit in the case, but if I sense that the government is not going to really take the case without a kickback angle or without some sort of other angle that the government has recently in the last decade has been more and more interested in, because, you know, oftentimes the case may have merit. I see the merit, the government may see the merit, but they might not have the resources to investigate. It's not really a matter of whether the case was, you know, the claims are not with, you know, they have merit, but they might not have the resources to explore it. So it's really important for us to assess that at the front end before we get to the government to see whether some of those claims might be meritable or whether they might be more attractive for the government to really take a bite out of those claims and to see if they want to investigate with us. Because the whole goal under the False Claims Act, it really is to work with the government, right? We are filing a case in whatever jurisdiction nationwide, and we want that U.S. attorney to really look into our claims, really take the time to investigate, and really work with us to go into the next step of approaching settlement or litigation against that defendant company that has clearly committed fraud.
All right. So you have a client, you've taken this client on, you believe the case has merit. What do you do? You mentioned working in conjunction with the government. What do you as private counsel for this client first do?
So a lot of the work I always tell them is, there's a lot of legwork that needs to be done on the front end. So we've got to file the complaint. We have to serve disclosure statement with all the different exhibits that they might have, the documentary evidence that they might have for me. And so a lot of that is done under seal, right? And so the immediate process provides a certain amount of anonymity for these clients, which some of my clients often find comforting because they might be employed with the company currently. And so that process is, you know, that's us. We do that, right? As a practicing attorney, we put the facts together. We create this narrative of the facts. We allege it in the complaint, file it with the state or federal court, serve, you know, the exhibits, the documentary evidence to the U.S. Attorney's Office. And after that, it's sort of like a waiting game, right? We wait for the government to investigate the case, ask us questions, talk to the relators, talk to the whistleblowers about what this case is, and let them do their own investigation and sort of be at their, I don't want to say disposal, but when they ask for things, we kind of have to be on top of it, right? And so we're in constant communication with the government to continue the investigation and help them get to a point where they can approach the defendant company in a matter where we might be looking at the best outcome for the clients.
Your client, who presumably has blown this whistle and you're doing this investigation, you've reported the claim, you filed your claim, any concern on the client's behalf that he or she's going to get fired or retaliated against in some other way?
Yes. Often our clients are, and like I said, these FCA cases are filed initially under seal, and so they're not available for the public record. So the immediate process itself for maybe the first 2 or 3 years might provide some anonymity for the clients who may be working for the defendant company, and they find that comforting, right? But that's not always, that's not always the case. There are federal and state whistleblower laws with anti-retaliation provisions implemented to prevent retaliation. And so for those current employees, these provisions provide pretty adequate protection from termination, demotion, discrimination, and any other types of retaliatory conduct that they might be observing within their workspace, right? And so so the short answer to the question is yes, there are some anti-retaliation provisions implemented to provide that protection for our whistleblowers that really, take the time to come forward with these cases.
So other than trying to stop this conduct from continuing, what's the benefit to the potential whistleblower for coming forward? What does he or she hope to gain?
So I hear a lot from my clients that they find, personal gratification in finally being able to tell their story to us, the government, and eventually the public. They also get satisfaction in being really heard and having the right folks review and investigate their case. And, you know, as their attorney, I try to play a role where I've tried to place the client in the best position possible, regardless of the outcome, right? Because that's important to me. That I hear a lot of that from my clients, you know, that they're quote unquote doing the right thing, that they've really been stressed in the workplace. They've, you know, mentally exhausted, seeing all the fraud, because a lot of the times, especially those folks working in the healthcare facility, they're working with patients. There might be patient risk. Patients might be dying because of some of this fraud. And this is, it's difficult for them. And so when they finally come to us and when they finally file the case, when they finally see that the government is sort of going in the right direction to investigate the case, they have this feeling of gratification and satisfaction that they're sort of being able to do the right thing and make sure that some justice is served for some of this fraud.
Very, very cool. And I want to thank you. Our time is up. I feel like we could do this for hours and hours. So we definitely want to have you back, Sarah. You've been awesome today. That's all we have. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks again for joining us today on JGL Law for You. Sarah, let me ask you a question. If folks are listening to this out there, want to reach you, want to reach out to you, they may have a case or want to talk to you, what's the best way for them to get hold of you?
I would say right now at this point, email would be the best, SCHU@JGLlaw.com. And so, you know, from a legal standpoint, going after fraud and abuse without the role of my client is not incredibly useful. And so my clients bring a lot to the table, and we, JGL, really appreciate and value whistleblowers coming forward with these types of cases. And so if you have anything, especially during there's a lot of buzz around COVID-related fraud right now. And so if you see or hear anything, email me, SCHU@JGLlaw.com. And I hope you listeners found this episode informative.
I'm sure they have. My guess is we're going to have you back to talk about this again. Thanks to everybody for listening in. Please join us next time. I'm David Bullitt, and this is JGL Law for You.